Well, we were talking about depolarizing potentials. A depolarizing potential is not the action potential. It is a change in membrane potential, so the voltage is changing. That's why we call it depolarizing. To depolarize means to make less polar, right? Remember that we call the cell polarized when it's at rest. This is an excitable cell. And an excitable cell, when it's just not being excited, is said to be at rest. Of course, it's not really at rest. Those pumps are continuously working just to keep it at rest, so-called rest. But anyway, in order to bring a cell, an excitable cell, to the point where an action potential will be created, you need to change the membrane potential from what it is at rest to whatever the threshold potential is. And that's an upward swing on the graph. The only way that's going to happen is if you have a depolarizing potential, because it's getting less polarized by going up in the graph, up towards zero. All right? So that is some sort of event. It depends on what the cell is as to what actually causes that depolarizing potential. But, I mean, for instance, it could be in response to being touched. Being touched could open up certain kinds of ion channels that will allow ions to flow through down their gradient. If positive ions are coming into the cell as in response to that event, whatever it is, then those positives coming into the cell are going to make the interior of the cell less negative, which would be an upswing. That would be an example of a depolarizing potential. All right. Now, if that happens with sufficient magnitude, enough ions flow, in other words, to bring it up to the specific voltage called the threshold potential, then an action potential will be created. And if not, an action potential will not be created. So only if threshold is reached will the action potential be created. And the action potential involves gated ion channels that are in the membrane, but they are an entirely different set of channels compared to the ones that actually open up to create the depolarizing potential that leads to the action potential. All right, there's all kinds of different proteins in the membrane at once. The pumps, the leak channels, which are not gated, and the gated ion channels of different types, some of which can cause these depolarizing potentials to bring it up to threshold. But once threshold is reached, then an entirely different set of proteins acting as voltage-gated ion channels come into play to create the action potential itself. Now we can finally talk about the action potential, which starts right where the red trace hits the dashed line, right at threshold. And it includes everything until it gets level again, labeled at number 5. That whole trace is one action potential. And that's being measured at one tiny place on the membrane of the axon. This is a neuron we're talking about, but really it happens the same way in a muscle cell as well. The point is, when you measure an action potential, it's a change in voltage during a time, but it's measured at one tiny place on the cell. If you were to measure what's happening at a different place on that same cell, it wouldn't be the same. So an action potential is happening at a very local slice of membrane on an excitable cell. The action potential itself has a drastic upswing on the graph, as you notice, and that is called the depolarizing part of the action potential. Now, you already had to have a depolarizing event in order to bring it up to threshold. That's not part of the action potential. The action potential itself, though, has a depolarizing part to it, or a depolarizing phase, and it's a little bit of a misnomer because it's depolarizing means making it towards zero, and notice it gets actually above zero. So when it gets above zero, it's actually repolarizing in a sense, but in the opposite direction. We still consider that to be depolarizing up until the peak. At the peak, it then turns around, the trace turns around, and the charge becomes more negative. During the depolarizing phase, it's becoming more positive, right? The interior surface of the membrane is becoming more positive. After it peaks out and descends on the trace, the interior of the cell is becoming less positive or more negative. And that part is called the repolarization phase. It's reestablishing the fact that it's negative inside and positive outside. So it's repolarizing. And that continues until the trough right here, the lowest point it gets, is the end of the repolarization phase. Notice then that it comes, well, notice that the repolarization brings it actually more negative than it was at rest to begin with. And so to recover, so to speak, to end that action potential and get back to where it was originally, the voltage needs to come back up slightly to the resting potential. And that part, which is the final part of the action potential itself, is sometimes called the after potential. All right? And the after potential really doesn't involve, well, it's just the time during which the after potential phase is the time during which equilibrium is reestablished with respect to the resting membrane potential. The pumps are operating continuously, but once the ions get situated again in the condition they were before anything happened, then the action potential is officially over and this thing is back at resting potential. A new action potential might be created right away, or it might not. It depends on what happens. But that action potential is done. Now, I said that the action potential itself is caused by voltage-gated ion channels. Well, there are two kinds of voltage-gated ion channels that work for the action potential. And those are voltage-gated sodium ion channels and voltage-gated potassium ion channels. Both of them are closed before the action potential occurs. And therefore, neither sodium nor potassium is flowing through those. Remember, there's other kinds of ion channels through which sodium and potassium can be flowing. But these ones are closed at rest. I told you last time that the sodium ion channels involved here, the voltage-gated sodium ion channels, are actually doubly gated. They have an activation gate and a deactivation gate. All right, but if either one of those is closed, then no sodium ions are flowing through. Now remember how the pump works. The pump pumps sodium ions where? Out of the cell. And meanwhile, at the same time, potassium ions into the cell. So because of the continuous operation of the pumps, we have the situation in which sodium ion concentration is always higher outside than in, and potassium ion concentration is always higher inside than out. That means, because of the pumps, there's always a tendency for these things to diffuse. A tendency is not actually diffusion, though, right? A tendency means that they will diffuse if they are able to. Diffusion requires two things, though, right? A gradient to drive that diffusion, and a way for that particle to be able to move from A to B, wherever those positions are, right? So, with the gates closed on these channels that are involved in the action potential, there isn't a lot of flow of potassium or sodium. They are voltage-gated ion channels, both of them. That means what opens up their gates is an actual voltage across the membrane. They're both triggered basically by the same threshold voltage, sodium ion channels and potassium ion channels. But sodium ion channels are a lot quicker to open up their gates than potassium ion channels. Okay? And that's important because you don't want sodium and potassium ions to flow at the same exact time. They would just undo each other, right? They are both positive ions. And the gradients are in opposite directions. So if you snap both of these kinds of ion channels open at exactly the same time, sodium is going to come into the cell, making the inside more positive, potassium is going to go out of the cell, making the inside less positive. They're going to undo each other. No change is going to occur, right? That's why it's important for sodium ion channels to open up quicker than potassium ion channels. Well, whatever the event was that caused this depolarization was sufficient to bring the voltage up to that special threshold voltage, and now sodium ion channels that are side by side with all these other proteins in the membrane open up. All right, their deactivation gate was already open, but the activation gate was closed. It's the threshold voltage that opens up that activation gate. So now they're both open. That means the channel is open. And because of the gradient, that means there's going to be a quick influx of sodium ions, meaning flow into the cell. They are positive ions. That means the inside of the membrane is going to become suddenly more positive. That's explaining the depolarization phase of the action potential. Now, that should just continue to go up, right? Because there's a big gradient with respect to sodium ions. And so it's important not to just let this keep going forever. It's important to peak it out, in other words. And that's why the sodium ion channels have two gates. When the voltage gets toward the peak, that's a voltage that actually causes the inactivation gates to close. And that keeps it from going upward forever. All right. So some sodium flows in enough to bring it up to the peak, and that new voltage closes those channels. So no more sodium coming into the cell. That explains why it doesn't continue to go up. But it has nothing to do with it coming back down, right? The reason now it comes back down on the repolarization phase is because by now, which is just a fraction of a millisecond later, these slightly slower to open voltage-gated potassium ion channels are now open, while the sodium ion channels have already closed. Well, the gradient for those is in the opposite direction, right? Potassium ions are going to have an efflux, a flow out of the cell. But since they are the same charge and going in the opposite direction, that means the opposite situation is going to happen with respect to the membrane potential. Taking positives out of the cell is going to make the interior of the membrane less positive, which is more negative. That explains the repolarization phase. And only when this thing gets back down to threshold potential will all the gates be reset. Notice, though, that it goes well below threshold potential. In fact, it goes below resting potential. And that's because not only are the potassium ion channels gates slow to open, they're also slow to close. So some additional potassiums leak out during this time that we call the after potential phase. And then once just these two types of channels, the ones that are involved in the action potential, are fully closed, then equilibrium can be reestablished and you have resting potential again. That all make sense? Okay, let's go to 7 then and talk about propagation of action potentials. I said a little bit ago that a single action potential is an event that's a change in membrane potential occurring just at a tiny region of the overall plasma membrane. This is a long cell, the neuron, and so an action potential is occurring just at one tiny slice of the membrane. We haven't gotten there yet in this picture. At the top, there is no action potential yet. But these dendrites, which are connected to other cells, are being stimulated. They are undergoing changes in their membrane potentials. The dendrites are. Now, those changes in membrane potential can be either depolarizing or hyperpolarizing, remember, right? But in this case, we're assuming that these incoming signals are causing local depolarizations of the dendrite plasma membranes. A change in voltage will spread in space and time, but it dissipates through distance. So if you cause a change in potential in one place, you'll see a change in voltage next to it. It just won't be quite as strong. and then a little bit farther away, it won't be as strong as that. So it dissipates in space. Okay? These local changes in potential that are not the action potential, but that can cause action potentials, are called graded potentials for that reason. Graded meaning that they can vary in magnitude. You can have a big change in potential, a small change in potential. And it can be in either direction, up or down, depolarizing or hyperpolarizing. Action potentials, on the other hand, are not graded. They don't vary in magnitude, which is why they are said to be all or none. An action potential is all or none because it either happens or it doesn't at all. And if it does happen, that peak is the same magnitude as any other action potential. So action potentials don't come in strong variety and weak variety. They are all the same within a single cell. Okay? Well, these red regions happen to be depolarizing local potentials occurring at the dendrites. And that is spreading over the surface of the neurosoma, or cell body of the neuron. If it reaches the spread in that change in voltage reaches the part where the body meets the axon, which is the axon hillock, that's where either an action potential is going to be created or not, depending on the change in membrane potential that occurs at that axon hillock. So if it's a depolarizing potential that's occurring at the axon hillock, and further, that depolarizing potential is of sufficient magnitude to bring it up to threshold, then those voltage-gated potassium and sodium ion channels come into play because of that threshold voltage, and the first action potential is created. That action potential is created just in this little slice of membrane, so that's represented by the red bar. Okay, so the action potential is not happening downstream of that. It's just happening right here at first. But an action potential is a voltage, right? And like I just said, voltages spread. So one action potential right at the axon hillock is actually going to change the voltage of the membrane right next to it. And it's going to bring it up to threshold, which means a new action potential is created right next door to the original one. And so on down the line. Each action potential creates a new action potential right beside it in the direction toward the axon terminal. So we often say that an action potential spreads to the end of the axon. That's actually not true. What we have is what's called action potential propagation. An action potential doesn't move. What we could measure is a chain reaction of action potentials. There are many action potentials created one after another, but each one is caused by the previous one. All right? That's action potential propagation. And so the voltage changes down the length of the axon until you finally reach the axon terminals. This is a good analogy that a lot of books use is the toppling of dominoes. If you set up dominoes and you just cause that first one to tip, they're all going to tip because each one's going to cause the next one to tip, right? That's a chain reaction. That's action potential propagation in a neuron. We can see that in cartoon form in slide 8, and using pluses and minuses for the charge. Notice that it's inside negative at rest. That first action potential is such that the sodium influx is going to cause the inside to be temporarily positive. That's the depolarizing part when it goes above zero. And then on the downswing, it's going to be reversed because potassium is leaving. That's going to make that section of the membrane more negative again. But because it was positive for a while, that right next door slice of membrane is going to be jolted into its own up to its own threshold, and therefore its own set of voltage-gated sodium ion channels are going to open up. That's going to lead to its own action potential. And so the second action potential, the action potential is not moving. The first one's causing a second. The second one will cause a third, and so on down the line. In 9, we're looking at a myelinated axon, or just a little section of the length of a myelinated axon. Axons might or might not be myelinated. Certain ones are, certain ones aren't. I told you already that if you have a myelinated axon, the myelin sheaths are not actually part of that cell. The myelin sheaths are caused by a different type of cell, not a neuron, but a neuroglial cell, N-E-U-R-O-G-L-I-A-L. There are neurons and there are neuroglia. There are different kinds of neuroglia as well, but one kind of neuroglial cell that wraps around the axons actually produce those. Those cells are the myelin sheaths. And each individual myelin sheath is a cell whose plasma membrane wraps several times around the axon. Like the axon is the cardboard core of toilet paper, and the toilet paper itself is the neuroglial cell that creates the myelin sheath. Well, a myelinated axon isn't completely myelinated. There will be several myelin sheaths all the way down the length of the axon, and between each pair of myelin sheaths, each adjacent pair, a tiny gap where there is no myelination. And those gaps are called nodes of Ranvier. All right? They are spaced apart regularly along the length of the axon. The reason that certain axons are myelinated is because myelination greatly increases the speed of propagation of action potentials, meaning that the information is going to get from the axon hillock to the neuron's axon terminal a lot faster in a myelinated axon than it is in an unmyelinated axon. Okay? Well, the reason why is because, slide 10, is because of electrical insulation that the myelin sheaths provide. There is no ion flow through the membrane at the places where the myelin sheaths are present. Only at the nodes of Ranvier do you have the ion flow that we talked about that gives rise to the action potentials. All right? So, when an action potential gets created originally, the first one at the axon hillock, it would normally, in an unmyelinated sheath, make another action potential right next to it, right? But in a myelinated axon, right next to it is insulated by myelin sheath. So it doesn't create an action potential right next to it. But because of the flow of ions inside the cell and outside the cell, horizontally in this picture, there still will be a jolt of the section of membrane right at the next node of Ranvier, sufficient to bring it up to threshold, and therefore the next node of Ranvier will undergo an action potential. And then that one will jolt the next node of Ranvier into an action potential. But that's a farther spacing of action potentials compared to an unmyelinated axon. In the dominoes analog, this is analogous to saying, okay, we need to have the dominoes set up from one side of this table to the other. And you could have them very close together. That would represent an unmyelinated axon. You're going to need a lot more dominoes to do that. Or you could space them out, right? It would travel the same, the propagation would be the same distance when they're spaced out, but it would require fewer dominoes, fewer action potentials. And therefore, it would be quicker. Notice, by the way, that you can't space these out indefinitely. The maximum spacing would be the height of the domino, right? Because if it's more than that, a domino falling is not going to create the next one's falling. Similarly, on these nodes of Ranvier, they've evolved to the point where they're spaced out about as far as they can be. If they were spaced out more, then there wouldn't be enough flow of ions horizontally to bring the next node of Ranvier up to threshold. And therefore, even though it might be a depolarizing potential, below threshold means nothing would happen. And so the action potential would die out. That doesn't happen because these things are spaced out just the right amount. They've maximized their spacing to maximize the speed of propagation without going so far that the action potential will not be sent all the way to the end. Does that make sense? Okay. Now to 11. We're looking at a synapse here. A synapse, just the word by itself, refers to a place where a neuron, which is an excitable cell, connects with some downstream cell. Now, that downstream cell could be another neuron, but not necessarily. It could be a muscle cell, it could be a gland, it could be a neuron. But the first one is a neuron, all right? The upstream one in terms of the flow of information is a neuron, and then some other cell, which we call the postsynaptic cell. There's a presynaptic cell, which is a neuron. There's a postsynaptic cell, which could or could not be a neuron. Anyway, there are two different kinds of synapses, functionally speaking. The one we're looking at here is actually more unusual than the one we'll look at next. This is an electrical synapse, so called because it features gap junctions in that synapse that allow for the flow of ions directly through the gap junctions, and therefore the flow of ions from one cell to another. In an electrical synapse, an action potential in the presynaptic cell gets propagated not only to the end of that neuron, which is the presynaptic cell, but continues to propagate directly down the length of the postsynaptic cell. All right. In other words, the final action potential in the neuron causes an action potential directly in the beginning of that postsynaptic cell. That's an electrical synapse. And these are important, for instance, in your heart muscles. Your heart muscles are excitable cells, and for the heart to function properly as a pump, it's important for all those muscle cells to contract at the same time within a chamber. That way they efficiently expel blood from that chamber into the next thing, which is either another chamber or an artery. So you really only need a neuron to zap the first muscle cell into action potential. And then since it's connected by gap junctions at intercalated discs with other muscle cells of the heart, the action potentials will be propagated from one muscle cell to the next. Those are electrical synapses. But that's actually not how most of your synapses work. Most of them are examples, as in slide 12, of what are called chemical synapses. So this one I don't think is labeled chemical synapse anywhere, but that's what we're looking at here. This is the more usual type of synapse. And this is exactly the kind of synapse, for instance, that occurs between a motor neuron and a skeletal muscle cell, allowing your muscle to contract. It's consciously controlled, right? So when you have an intention to move a muscle, what you do is really create an action potential in a neuron that then triggers the muscle to contract. But it's an indirect process in a chemical synapse compared to an electrical synapse. The reason it's called a chemical synapse is because action potentials are not propagated from pre- to postsynaptic cell. The action potential train gets terminated in the presynaptic terminal, in the presynaptic cell, but that then causes the release of a chemical. That's why it's named chemical synapse. And the release of that chemical can then cause a brand new train of action potentials in the postsynaptic cell. All right, that's a more indirect process. So we already talked about what the chemicals are that are released from a neuron. What are they in general called?
Neurotransmitters,
right. Neurotransmitters are just chemicals. They are operating as signals, though, so they're chemical signals, whereas the action potentials are electrochemical signals, right? When the... let me go to another slide that shows you the detail of that. Before I leave this one, though, notice that the neurotransmitters that are released from the neuron terminal at a chemical synapse are ready to go already when the action potential reaches, or when the action potential gets created at that end of the line of the neuron, the neuron already has vesicles filled with neurotransmitter molecules ready to be exocytosed. And so the action potential that's the last one in line in the neuron at that axon terminal causes the exocytotic release of neurotransmitters into the tiny space that's actually between the two cells. A synapse, in a chemical synapse, you don't have direct contact between the plasma membrane of the presynaptic cell and the postsynaptic cell. There's a tiny gap called the synaptic cleft, and that is outside of both cells, right? So it's a tiny volume of extracellular fluid. But that's the space into which neurotransmitters are released in response to the neuronal action potential. Well, let's go to 13 now and look at ways in which neurotransmitters can have their effects. Neurotransmitters generally operate by either directly or indirectly opening or closing ion channels. If you open or close an ion channel, you're going to affect the plasma membrane potential of the cell that has those channels in it, which in this case would be the postsynaptic cell, right? If you open or close channels, then you're going to change the voltage. That's a change in membrane potential. And depending on what kind of ion channels you open or close, that change can be either depolarizing, an upward swing on the graph, or hyperpolarizing, a downward swing. All right? But the neurotransmitters do their job simply as ligands. Neurotransmitters are examples of ligands, which is an even more general term, right? A ligand is something that binds to something else. In this case, the ligand, the neurotransmitter, binds to a receptor protein that is specific for that type of neurotransmitter. But the story is the same. If that binding occurs between ligand and receptor, neurotransmitter and receptor in other words, then there's going to be a conformational change in that receptor protein. It's going to change its shape. Therefore, something's going to happen in response to that binding of the neurotransmitter that wouldn't happen if the neurotransmitter were not present. Well, the direct way in which ion channels get opened or closed by neurotransmitters is if the channel itself is also a receptor for that neurotransmitter. That's what we're seeing in A. That's why it's called direct neurotransmitter action. So the pink protein embedded in the membrane here is a gated ion channel. It's specifically a ligand-gated ion channel because the key that opens up its gate is a ligand, not a voltage. It's a specific particle that needs to bind to a receptor site that's also part of that same protein. The reddish ball here is the neurotransmitter itself. And so in response to the binding of the neurotransmitter, in this case, what was a normally closed ion channel gets opened up. Now let's say that that is a sodium ion channel. The opening of that is going to cause what kind of flow of sodium ions? Influx, right, because of the gradient with respect to sodium. And what is that going to do to the membrane potential? It's going to be a depolarizing potential because it's going to make the inside less negative, more positive. All right. So that's the sort of thing that could lead, if enough of them open up for enough sodium ions to flow, to attainment of that threshold potential. If only a few of them open up and you have just a few sodium ions come through, it will be a depolarizing potential, but it won't get to threshold, and so it'll just die out in time, and the cell will not create an action potential. But if you have enough of these things open up so that sodium comes in great enough abundance, then the depolarizing potential is at least enough to bring it up to threshold. By the way, if it's enough to bring it way beyond threshold, still no change in the action potential. And action potentials are all or none. So you can either kiss that threshold or go way beyond it, doesn't matter. The same kind of action potential will be created because those totally different sets of proteins will be acting as the channels responsible for the action potential itself. All right? Now, the more indirect way is for the receptor not to be a channel, but it's a membrane-bound protein that changes shape in response to the ligand binding to it. It's just that that change in shape is going to cause something else to happen that will ultimately have the effect of opening an ion channel. All right? And that's because proteins can interact with each other when they're bound to the membrane. The ultimate effect is the same, though, in either case. Ions flow one way or another, and therefore the membrane potential gets changed from what it was at rest before this neurotransmitter was released. 14. Here we're looking at a chemical synapse, and we can see what's causing the exocytotic release of neurotransmitter in response to action potential being created at the axon terminal. So this whole thing started, let's just say that this is a motor neuron, and it's synapsing with a skeletal muscle cell that you're intending to move, right? When you intend to bend your elbow, you're invoking your biceps brachii muscle. But what happens first is your intention in your brain. So that creates an action potential in that motor neuron at the axon hillock. That's not shown here. That action potential creates another action potential right next to it, and so on. Propagation all the way down the axon length for that that motor neuron. So this is the end of the line of that motor neuron. The action potential chain reaction eventually will reach the axon terminal. And so now the membrane potential of that little slice of plasma membrane making up the axon terminal is changing. And it's going from negative to positive because of its own action potential, right? Well, embedded in that membrane, along with all the other ones we've been talking about, are still other voltage-gated ion channels in this axon terminal. And those are specifically voltage-gated calcium ion channels that normally are closed. Their special voltage that opens them up, though, is reached by that action potential. That action potential is the voltage that will open up voltage-gated calcium ion channels at the axon terminal. Now, we didn't talk about it really, I don't think, but the situation for calcium ions is much the same as for sodium ions, meaning that the extracellular fluid has a higher calcium ion concentration than the intracellular fluid. So, if calcium ion channels exist and they are open, then calcium, of course, is going to diffuse down its gradient, but that means it's going to go into the cell. Those calcium ion channels do exist in the axon terminal's plasma membrane, but they're normally closed. When the action potential comes along, that voltage opens them up. So calcium ions flow from the extracellular fluid, which is what fills the synaptic cleft, into the axon terminal itself. Calcium is a signal that's used often by cells for various reasons. This is just one example. So the influx of calcium has the effect of triggering the exocytosis of vesicles that contain neurotransmitter and that have been prepared, ready to go already. All right? So that's what we see in the middle here. The calcium coming in causes these vesicles filled with neurotransmitter to fuse with the plasma membrane, open up, and release their contents into the synaptic cleft. Synaptic cleft is a tiny distance, which means diffusion works very well, as it always does over very short distances. So these neurotransmitters don't have to travel very far. They quickly reach their destination. The destination specifically is a group of ligand-gated ion channels that are embedded in the plasma membrane of the postsynaptic cell. All right? They happen to be specific for that particular neurotransmitter. And therefore, in response to the binding of the neurotransmitter released by the neuron, the ligand-gated ion channels in the membrane of the postsynaptic cell open up. And there is flow of ions What those ions are depend on the situation, the cell type. But there is, since there's flow of ions, this means you're no, the postsynaptic cell is no longer going to be at resting potential. It's going to be something else. It might be even below resting potential, in which case that would be a hyperpolarizing potential, or it could be less polarized, an upward swing. That would be a depolarizing potential. Notice that if it's a hyperpolarizing potential that's created in the postsynaptic cell, that makes that postsynaptic cell even less likely to create its own action potential, to fire, so to speak. All right? A hyperpolarizing potential can never lead to action potential. It's going in the opposite direction, making it less likely. A depolarizing potential might make an action potential in the postsynaptic cell, but only if it's sufficiently strong to bring it up to threshold. Okay? Let's go to 15 now and look at these docked vesicles. The docking proteins that you see here are a way to keep these vesicles that are full of neurotransmitter molecules very close to the plasma membrane, but not yet kissing the plasma membrane, so that they are still fully inside the cell. There's no neurotransmitter release until it gets the signal via an action potential to open up voltage-gated calcium ion channels. The calcium coming in is going to disrupt this whole docking structure, and it's going to cause release of these vesicles to the plasma membrane, where their contents get spilled into the synaptic cleft. Their contents is the group of neurotransmitter molecules. 16 now. We're looking at a neurosoma of a neuron here with many dendrites on it. And there are all kinds of different kinds of neurons, actually, with respect to how many dendrites there are. But a single neuron can have an almost unbelievably a high number of dendrites on it, so many more than this cartoon actually indicates. The point here, though, is that the dendrites, remember, are inputs. They're receiving signals. And so this one neuron that we're looking at itself can be a postsynaptic cell. All right. Each one of its dendrites can actually feature a synapse with a neuron upstream of it. So when we're talking about presynaptic and postsynaptic cells, it's not just one cell connecting to one cell. A postsynaptic cell can actually have hundreds of thousands of separate upstream cells synapsing onto it. All right? But those synapses between the upstream cell, not shown here, and the downstream cell, or the postsynaptic cell, those occur at the postsynaptic neuron's dendrites, which are the inputs into that downstream cell. All right? All of the presynaptic neurons that are also not shown here, but that, well, actually, they're kind of shown. They're shown as the red and the green dots. Those are the connection points. All of those upstream neurons are either not doing anything, they're just at rest, because no action potential has been sent down them, or they're firing. If they're firing, the upstream neurons are releasing their own neurotransmitters, right? Some neurotransmitters cause the opening of gates in the postsynaptic neuron that we're looking at, such that the ion flow causes a hyperpolarizing potential. For instance, if you open up a chloride ion channel, chloride is an anion that is in greater abundance in the extracellular fluid, just like sodium is, but it's the opposite charge. Therefore, when you open up a chloride ion channel, negatives come into the cell. That makes the trace downward. That's a hyperpolarizing potential. Okay? That's going to make it even less likely for this downstream neuron to fire an action potential. But some of the other upstream neurons, by releasing their neurotransmitter, are opening up different channels that will cause a depolarizing potential. Those are the green dots. right? For instance, they're opening up sodium ion channels in the dendrites, and therefore sodium coming in is making the trace more positive. So each individual synapse between a presynaptic neuron and this postsynaptic neuron is a vote, in a sense, as to whether this postsynaptic neuron should create its own action potential, should fire. All right, and it depends on how many votes you have in each direction as to whether the neuron is actually going to create an action potential. Every red dot here represents a no vote because it's a hyperpolarizing potential. So you have hyperpolarizing potentials in every one of these red spots. You have depolarizing potentials occurring in all of the green spots. And so, like I said, changes in potential will travel in space a certain, they'll dissipate as they go, but all of these things are being integrated. All of these potentials, these voltages, are being integrated. Integration is a major function of the nervous system. It's integration makes sense of all the various inputs and then creates an output. Okay? But integration is really just adding these things together, counting the votes. So all the hyperpolarizing ones are creating a more negative, all the depolarizing ones are creating a more positive, and as this whole wave of voltage change reaches the axon hillock, it's going to add up to a certain change. Or actually, it's going to add up to something. Maybe no change at all. Maybe, if there's exactly as much positivity as negativity, it's going to stay right at rest at the axon hillock, and therefore it's not going to change. That would be, same number of yes votes as no votes, basically. But if the yeses win out, then you'll have a depolarizing potential reach the axon hillock. That still, though, does not mean that this neuron is going to fire, because you could have a insufficiently strong depolarizing potential at the axon hillock, which will bring it up, but not quite to threshold. So once again, it would do nothing. If the sum of all these, though, is such that you do bring it up to threshold, then you're going to have an action potential by definition, because that's the threshold potential. And once you have that action potential, it doesn't matter how the votes were cast. The result is the only thing that matters, an action potential. And that action potential is going to be propagated down the length of the axon, undiminished. So action potentials do not die out. They reinforce each other. Each one is just as strong as the previous one. So the signal goes all the way to the end and creates the release of, or leads to the release of the neurotransmitter of this neuron, whatever it does. Now, it could be connected to still another neuron. So there's all kinds of complexity, of course. But the point is here about what happens with the postsynaptic neuron. This, by the way, is why you have hyperpolarizing potentials. When you first learn about hyperpolarizing potentials, you say, well, why would you bother with that? Because if you don't do anything, just keep it at rest, it doesn't fire. Why would you bother to make it go even lower? Well, the reason is so that you can actually undo a yes vote to keep it at level. Okay? Yes, if all you had were things that could cast no votes, it would be useless. But you have yes votes and no votes can undo the yes votes. So we are probably close enough to stop there.